This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with three scientists who are authorities on the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, Dr. Eugene Turner, Drs. Nancy Rabelais and Kathy Kling. They will be with us to give us the latest on whether or not this is a threat to our area. It's something that these scientists and others have battled with for several years, and there are some new developments. Also, Bernie Pinsonat, the well-versed pollster on qualifying this week as candidates line up to run for the November 4th election, which is getting close. And Bernie Pinsonat on the latest stories regarding Mary Landrieu's travel. And Bobby Jindal says he's praying about whether he should run for president. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, or you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Frank Barnett is producing. Thanks to Jim Nickel, who did a superb job this past Friday hosting in the absence of yours truly. It's good to be back. And later in the hour, we will hear from Bernie Pinsonat. This is a big week as far as Louisiana politics, with qualifying for elections that will be held on the fourth day of November. An issue that is among us and has been for some time is the dead zone, and it's something that is not often talked about on shows of this kind, but this is a good opportunity to hear from three scientists who are on the cutting edge of what is going on in the Gulf of Mexico. And we start with Dr. Eugene Turner, who's been at LSU for 40 years and has spent much of those 40 years studying the dead zone, which is an oxygen issue in our oceans and lakes and caused by things like pollution from human activities coupled with other factors that deplete the oxygen required to support most marine life. And, of course, this has an impact on our economy and on coastal erosion. Good morning, Gene Turner.
Good morning.
What's the biggest concern?
There are concerns within the state and outside the state. So within Louisiana, the major focus at the moment is on the effect it has or may continue to have and develop to be worse on fisheries. Louisiana's fisheries, of course, are of national importance, being about 30% of the value and weight, depending on how you look at it. And this is the area they're caught in, the area where this low oxygen zone forms during the year and mostly during the summer.
This zone that you refer to, through the years, it's been measured at wildly different lengths. How big is it right now?
Well, our annual monitoring survey, which is also a research trip, is in late July, maybe the first week in August, and it was this year about the size of Connecticut. It's been the size of Massachusetts, and it's been non-existent in 1988 with the drought. It stretches from, well, actually, it goes on the east side of the river sometimes, but from the tip of the Mississippi River into Texas waters. Sometimes it's close to the beach, and it can go maybe 100 miles offshore, and it's on the bottom waters. It's on the bottoms, and it's large. It's the second largest in the world, and it's certainly the largest in the U.S.
So, ballpark figure right now,
it's about 5,000 square miles.
What does that mean as far as life as we know it?
Well, it's been characterized as being a dead zone because the oxygen gets low enough that if the animal at the bottom of the water column now can leave, it will leave. And that means shrimp, croaker, things you might feed on down there. If they can be food for these predators, they might leave as well. And they can be harmed temporarily, just kind of asphyxiated, almost dead, and rebound if the oxygen raises it, its concentration again.
297-5633, if you'd like to join the conversation, and we will hear not only from Gene Turner, which we just did, but two other established scientists on this issue, including Dr. Nancy Rabelais, who joins us. She is the executive director of the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. Good morning, Dr. Rabelais.
Good morning, Jim. Nice to hear you.
Nice to talk with you. Now, I'm looking at a story from 1998, January 20th, when Monica Lewinsky was first becoming a household word in America. A story that was on the front page of the Times, along with Lewinsky. A dead zone grows in the Gulf of Mexico. It can stretch for 7,000 square miles off the coast of Louisiana. So we've dealt with this for some time. Should we be alarmed, or is this just something that's part of life as we know it?
Well, we should be concerned with it, and it's not natural. The Gulf is probably primed to have these areas of low oxygen, but they've gotten worse since the 1950s, certainly since the 1970s, and they've not always been there because we've done studies of the sediments that show that it's not a natural feature, that it's gotten worse over time and aggravated. So it's something that's going to be with us now until we do something about the overload of the nitrogen and phosphorus in the Mississippi River.
Well, Gene Turner mentioned the cost as far as our seafood industry, and the Gulf boasts about 2 billion pounds of fish and shellfish caught each year, worth anywhere from $30 to $40 billion, maybe more. It is big business we're talking about. Is that jeopardized significantly by the so-called dead zone?
The shrimp fishery is able to rebound, but what is happening is that the juvenile shrimp hit this mass of low-oxygen water as they try to migrate offshore to grow to be bigger. So they're either being caught at a smaller size, or they're not being caught at their large capacity size that they could be. So it's basically lost production and lost income. Now, a lot of other things drive the fishery, including the price of diesel fuel and the tonnage of imports of shrimp can drive the price down, and sometimes it just means the trawler is just not going to go offshore because there's no sense. They can't make any money.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757. The dead zone is the topic for a little bit longer, and Kathy Kling joins us. She is a professor of agriculture and life sciences and economics at Louisiana State University. At Iowa State, where she not only teaches, but also her husband does as well. And by the way, Nancy and Gene are married, so we have a family affair converging about the dead zone. Now, you're in, Ames, Iowa, Kathy Kling. How do you have such a distinct interest in what happens in the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, thanks for having me on the show, and greetings from the central of the source of where much of these nutrients are coming from, the Gulf. And then, in short, that's really the answer to why I'm interested in and involved. The Mississippi River Basin is an enormous part of the continental U.S., something like 40% of the continental U.S. is drains into the Gulf of Mexico and takes with it lots of nutrients, and lots of those nutrients that are causing this exaggeration of the dead zone are coming from the Corn Belt, and hence the interest of an environmental agricultural economist in the issue. It's a fundamental problem of trade-offs, where if we're going to address the dead zone, reduce the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus flowing into the zone, and we're going to have to make some changes in how we do agriculture in the north, and that's the area of which I'm looking at and interested in.
297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Our guests are Gene Turner, Nancy Rabelais, and Kathy Kling, all scientists. Gene and Nancy are local, and Kathy is joining us from Ames, Iowa, America's heartland. Doug on Perkins, good morning to you, Doug. You're on WRKF.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, everybody. I had a question about the national policy response to this problem, which goes back over a couple decades, really, and there is a national action plan that your guests are all well aware of, and part of the reasoning behind that was it was in the national interest to clean this up, and we weren't going to wait for something like a fisheries crash or something major to happen. We were going to, as a nation, begin to address it just prudentially. But I was curious to see what the guests think now in terms of where we are and what can be done.
All right. Gene?
Well, good morning, Doug. Federal, state, tribal agreement, which was signed in 2001, has met a lot of times, and they've made some efforts, but so far there's been absolutely no reduction in the size of the amount of nutrients coming down the river as a result of those actions. And in fact, the USGS estimates that there's been a slight increase. So, and I would say that the state of Louisiana's contribution to that has been minimalist. So the it hasn't gotten too far. It's a huge problem. It's developed because of land use practices over 100 years. Of course, it couldn't be solved in or addressed easily because it's embedded in the economic and political, social aspects that's gone along with that agricultural development. But basically, the multi-state agreement really hasn't generated much of a response at all. And you might ask if there are other things we could add to that repertoire of responses. And the answer is yes, there are, but there's impediments in the way. This is, in part, you know, the diagnosis, you know, the forensics of this are that we can figure out why it's caused in a kind of on-the-ground way, but it's very difficult to tease apart these social, political, economic issues in order to come to a solution that keeps farmlands working.
Nancy?
Well, I just attended a landscape conservation cooperative meeting in Memphis last week, and their focus is to for wildlife conservation, but in the process, they can also work towards habitat that reduces nutrient flow into the streams and into the Gulf of Mexico, such as reoccupying some floodplains or building some artificial wetlands. They did talk about different types of crops and different types of crop rotation and fertilizer rates and different ways that farming could be done differently and actually more sustainably into the future than the current corn-soybean rotation. That type of activity will take out some of the nutrients if they can be implemented, but the big source is, of course, grain, land, crop rows, soybean, corn rotation, and that's going to take a different set of solutions to put over a broad scale, and that takes some social and political will. So one farmer might not do it until their neighbor has done it, or it's economically feasible, especially when the U.S. farm policy subsidizes these crops instead of subsidizing what could be conservation methods that might make the croplands less leaky of the nutrients.
Kathy?
Yeah, that's all fits quite well with what I would add, which is that the Corn Belt is, there's 130 to 140 million acres of corn and soybean land up here. And that land contributes not equally, but broadly to the issue. So, unfortunately, solving the hypoxia nutrient problem is not a case where we can just treat or deal with a small amount of land. This has to be a change that occurs across this very large landscape. And as Nancy rightly noted, corn-soybean rotation is very leaky. The reason for that is partly that we plant corn and beans on the summer, then we harvest, and there's nothing on the landscape in the winter. So there's nothing there to sort of soak up nutrients, keep soils and sediments on the land. There are lots of new interesting things going on, looking at cover crops, looking at changing rotations to possibly some sorts of perennials that might, for example, grow biofuels. But those are all things that take a big change and are costly, and we simply don't have the incentives, the financial incentives in place now for that to happen.
297-5633, your number. We shall return with Gene Turner, Nancy Rabelais, and Kathy Kling discussing the dead zone. In 1999, it was as big as the state of New Jersey. Back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Three distinguished professors on the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Dr. Catherine Kling joining us from Iowa State University. Dr. Nancy Rabelais is the executive director, professor at LSU, and she directs the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. And Gene Turner brings 40 years of experience as a scientist at Louisiana State University by way of the University of Georgia to this subject. And I quoted that 1998 story that was in the New York Times, and Nancy was mentioned in that story. It says you can swim and not see any fish. And we're talking about the dead zone. Donald in Mid-City. Good morning, Donald. You're on the air with Gene, Nancy, and Kathy. Hi, Donald.
Hey, hello, Mr. Inkster. Yeah, I just attended an EPA hearing in Houston concerning it was not just a dead zone, but it had to do with EPA emissions from chemical plants. There were about 40 other schools and agencies there, and a subject that was brought up was the topic that you're talking about. One of the things, my question is, it's economically a disadvantage for the people that we need to help curtail that. Is there any way or any extent that we can get through the state or the government and assistance from the federal government?
All right. I think he's along the same lines as Doug Daigle, our earlier caller, but what about assistance from the government on this, and whether or not it is sufficient to address the issue?
It's a general question for a lot of environmental problems that are embedded in this matrix. That who's going to provide the help here? What assistance is needed, and how can they help? And these are, in this case, it's a national agricultural policy that drives the cropping system in the Midwest, which has created this excessive amount of nutrients coming down over the last 50 years. So federal assistance in terms of policy development is absolutely necessary. One state cannot operate on its own very easily. The transition from farm subsidies mm-hmm. from one crop to the other, because now they're limited to seven major crops, it's absolutely required, and it hasn't happened. It's going to be a very mm-hmm. difficult task.
Kathy, you being an agricultural economist, I'd like to get your take on the estimates from the government, which state that 56% of the nitrogen entering the Gulf of Mexico comes directly from agricultural runoff. Is that one of the big culprits in the dead zone?
Yeah, absolutely. And in order to treat that problem, as Gene and Nancy have said, we're going to have to make some major changes in the way we do agriculture. Whether that means we stay with the traditional cropping systems we have and make changes to how we do them, like put cover crops on them in the winter, or we look for completely fundamental changes in the set of crops we grow, either way, we're going to have to acknowledge that this is going to come, require change, and that change is going to require costs to somebody. And the gentleman that just called Donald was asking whether this could be done by state or federal governments, and one answer is potentially yes, but it's going to be extremely expensive, and we have not seen in the last several decades or few years even, a willingness to pay from the state coffers or through government programs the size of change that would be needed. The alternative is to have some forms of regulation, which there's a lot of people that are very uncomfortable and don't want to see regulation. And the third option is to hope that and work on voluntary sort of approaches, which is the basic goal and plan of the Hypoxia Task Force, that we can see to encourage change on a broad-based level with voluntary adoption and changes in how farming is done.
Will in South Baton Rouge. Good morning, Will. You're on WRKF.
Good morning. It seems to me that we need to get more news out about this kind of problem. And it's obvious that when we have topics like this, you know, they're not beating the doors down to a call into your show, for instance. But it's a matter of education and disseminating news about this kind of a problem. We need to somehow get the media to cover it more. Obviously, news you know, goes to the thing which sells their papers or media services first, and that's usually news about things like what's going on up in St. Louis or other things around the world. But it should be a topic that's covered in schools, mm-hmm. and you know, made a part of our way of life. Thanks.
I think Will is correct. If a missing airliner went in the dead zone, suddenly the dead zone would get a great deal more attention. Lynn in Melrose. Good morning, Lynn. You're on WRKF.
Good morning, Jim, and your guests. With respect to the last comment, the last caller, yesterday Sylvia Earle was interviewed on the Bob Edwards Weekend. She's a world authority on the Gulf of Mexico, and she mentioned the dead zone, of course, in some detail. My comment is, having worked for in the governor's office for many years and tried to energize the state interest in hypoxia unsuccessfully, I would say, I think we need to point out that there has been no support from our state administration in terms of promoting the need to reduce the hypoxic zone, or even to publicize the problem. It's been treated like a stepchild with respect to the Coastal Restoration Program, always just put on the back burner and hoping that somebody else will fix it. Whereas the governor, most of the nitrogen is not coming from Louisiana, but our governor has a bully pulpit. He has some influence with the state of Iowa and Indiana and Minnesota and Ohio. But I'm not seeing any evidence of any interest from the state.
Dr. Rabelais, would you respond to Lynn Barr, our good friend?
This is Nancy. I would agree with Lynn. It's been an issue for a long time. It's been difficult to get the state to pay attention to it and to get our neighbors to pay attention to it as well. Because if Louisiana were required to clean up the river before it got into the Gulf of Mexico, you know the finger would start pointing northward and asking for help to clean up the river, but right now it's just not being done.
I'd like to add that it's of not only something that's one end of the pipe to the other. What happens down here isn't just an offshore issue. It's also with river diversions. We're adding this water into the very area that we want to restore, and there are consequences for that. This is not the same river as when the Europeans arrived in the watershed. It's got 5 or 6 times more nitrogen and phosphorus, mm-hmm. and those things damage the wetlands. And several of us think that that's the reason why we lost 1/3 of the wetlands in the flow path of the Carnarvon diversion. That it was not a help, it was a hindrance. And so when we have more river diversions, we need to consider the effect of the water quality, not just how much sediments are in it.
Yeah, Dr. Kling, the Mississippi River supplies about, over half the farms in the U.S. are adjacent to the river. So how does this affect long-term agriculture in this country?
If we were to make major require changes or make changes that require farms to reduce the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus, that could certainly raise prices and costs, but probably not very much. And in exchange for that, we would be dealing with these nutrient problems that hit the Gulf of Mexico, but we would also be dealing with local water quality. It's the same nutrients that are contributing to the problems that we have with water quality stream as well. Many of our lakes, rivers, and streams do not meet EPA's criteria for their intended uses, and if we were to address them, the issues that relate to Gulf would also help to clean up the water here.
Russ on Perkins. Good morning, Russ. You're on WRKF with Drs. Kling, Rabelais, and Turner.
Hey, thank you. I have a couple of questions for your guest. Number one, that algae bloom that was in Lake Michigan, is that a direct result of the runoff? And then second question, New Orleans gets all of its drinking water from the river. And would this chemicals and such affect the water quality that that the city of New Orleans would get?
I'll jump in on the lake. It's Lake Erie. Wasn't Lake Michigan, and that's a great example of the upstream water quality problems that these nutrients occur create. So the short answer is yes. That's exactly the same set of nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, and that's occurring up in the watershed. And I'll let Gene answer the second.
Well, and I'd like to add that in Des Moines, Iowa, they have to remove the nitrate from the drinking water supply by a very expensive process in order to use it. And on the New Orleans question, when the river is low, there's enough light, and algae blooms take place on the Mississippi River, and you get the same taste, and you get some of the same organisms, and they occasionally have had to close off the had water quality problems in the New Orleans supply. The records go back for decades. They have these incidences where it has a funny taste and then a bad taste, and then nobody wants to drink it, just occasionally.
877-217-5757, wherever you are, for Drs. Rabelais, Turner, and Kling. Jim on airline. Jim, good morning. You're on WRKF.
Good morning, Jim. One of the books I found most interesting was The Art of Problem Solving. I believe the author was Joseph Alsop. His point was is that oftentimes in trying to solve something, we don't look at a broad enough picture. And every day I hear the same problem, and the problem is money on the federal and state level. And I begin to ask people whether or not the allowing a free market system to move offshore or to put their headquarters offshore for the purpose of saving taxes is really in the best interest of the United States. Seems like until we put our people back to work, there won't be the resources necessary to fix any of these problems.
Have you seen your budgets suffer as a result of philosophy by government in recent time?
Our research budgets, we've been doing this for 30 years, and we're on the edge of not having any funding. And as a lot of other people have experienced. And we pieced together something this year through two agencies instead of the one that's been supporting us. And next year it could be problematic. And so we've had problems, and it looks like they're only going to get more difficult.
Mm-hmm. How's the higher education budget in the state of Iowa, Dr. Kling?
We're doing a little better than we were a few years ago, but there's no question that funding for research is down broadly, and I think particularly areas like water quality and issues of the environment often get hit hardest when there's a need to or a sense of a need to pull back on research.
And Nancy, as head of the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, how's your funding?
Well, our funding has been going down like everybody else in the state. We're probably 35% less than we were about 5 years ago. The problem with LUMCON is that we cannot raise tuition and raise fees because we're not degree granting, so we have no way to make up extra income. So we're fighting inflation with a water hose that has nothing in it right now.
Chris writes, isn't this the same thing? He's, I guess, referring to the dead zone that caused the jubilees on coastlines in Mississippi and Louisiana decades ago.
That's correct. The jubilees occur when there's a lot of low oxygen offshore, and the winds come from the north, push the surface waters out, and pulls the bottom waters in, and it traps fish. And very often, it's not just a jubilee; it's a jubilee gone bad. It's a fish kill.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Good morning, Phil. You're on with Gene, Nancy, and Kathy.
Good morning, gentlemen, and Mr. Inkster. Yeah, I just wanted to. I'm sorry, but just to give some a hopeful looking to the future. I mean, the Dutch have been dealing with flooding and water control for a long time, and I think like 50 years out is what we need to be looking at. Because it can be just so daunting, you know, how big the problem is and how big it's been. And my question is, does anyone know, I know that Exxon uses millions of gallons of fresh groundwater from the Baton Rouge aquifer. What would it take for them to stop doing that? It's just going to put them out of business if they transfer over to using river water for their processes.
All right, Gene.
I couldn't answer that thoughtfully. It's obviously a large amount of water relative to the local aquifer, but in terms of its effect on the offshore area, it's a small amount of water and a small addition.
All right, Nancy.
Well, correct. It's always easier to be preventative than to find a solution.
All right.
And the area to make the big difference is in the middle of the country.
Okay.
Not to expect Louisiana to solve the problem.
We're short on time in this segment, but a question from a listener, Susan, about the dredging project at LSU for the lakes. Gene and Nancy, do you think this is a good idea?
Well, the lakes are an iconic presence for the campus. They're dredged out of swamp. And there's a lot of, in a microcosm example of what's happened offshore. There's lawns, road runoff.
So is dredging the answer?
And it's adding one solution that'll be temporary.
So we'll have to do it all over again?
Well, we have to have maintenance on a system that's so intensely using the landscape. Right. And if we want that iconic presence, you're going to have to continue to do that.
Nancy?
I love looking at the lakes, but I don't like looking at scummy water, so I would encourage the neighbors to quit using so much fertilizer on their lawns.
And the pipes are leaky, too, the sewage pipes.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Eugene Turner, Nancy Rabelais, and Kathy Kling, and this is a topic that unfortunately will not go away overnight, so I'm sure have a chance to revisit it at some point very soon, but appreciate your comments and your insights today.
Thank you for having us on.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
My pleasure. And we shall return with the esteemed pollster from Southern Media and Opinion Research, Bernie Pinsonet, with some thoughts about the November 4th election. Qualifying is this Wednesday, back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, 877-217-5757, and inkstershow@wrkf.org. And you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Bernie Pinsonet in studio as we approach qualifying this week for the November 4th election. And when you think about November 4th, we're talking about 10 weeks now, something like that.
Yes, Louisiana.
11 weeks.
Louisiana's in, which we don't see very often, we actually have two interesting congressional races. Normally in Louisiana, we elect them, they stay there a long time, and very seldom are they challenged. So this year, Louisiana has a congressman running for the Senate, and then we have a we have a congressman who thought was going to be there a long time and may be in trouble, or is in trouble.
Who are you talking about? Vance McAllister?
Vance McAllister.
Vance Romance McAllister? You don't think he's going to win?
Well, it's one thing to divulge that you've made up with your wife and everything's fine. It's another thing to have an actual video. A video is tougher to overcome than accusations.
So if there had been a video of David Vitter he would not have survived?
Well, probably not, but...
picture's worth a thousand words, right?
Exactly.
Okay. And, of course, we've got Edwin Washington Edwards, who probably will be up early in the morning on Wednesday. My guess is that he will qualify first thing, and he's in a race with a cast of thousands, or so it seems.
Yes, he has a lot of candidates. Most, I'm speaking not as someone who's polled the race, but most think he'll be in the runoff, and who he faces with that many candidates is pretty much anybody's guess right now.
Garrett Graves, one of his challengers, is slated to be with us tomorrow, and we've had Dan Clater recently. He's been on this show, as have some of the others in that race. But how do you view the race to be in the runoff with Edwards? I would think it's almost a given that Edwin Edwards will be in a runoff with one of the Republicans. Which Republican is likely to make the cut?
At this point in time, I have no idea. I haven't conducted a poll in the race. You have candidates releasing surveys. Most of the time when they release their surveys, they probably leave out most of the data. So I don't really know. You've got some well-financed candidates. You've got state representative of state senator. You've got someone who is a public official. And you have a cast of characters, as you referred to them.
And young Dietzel, too, who may be the best organized of all of them.
Well, he's obviously... the question is, well, is it the Dietzel name, will that translate into votes? A lot of times, it depends on his campaign, depends on how he performs. When you get into the last few weeks of a campaign, people, it's not so much name recognition. They'll pick out a name they know. Towards the end, it's are you getting votes and transferring the name recognition into actual votes? So we've yet to see if he can do that.
297-5633 is your number for Bernie Pinsonat. Governor Bobby Jindal said on MSNBC's Morning Joe, where he is more likely to appear than on any local show, that he's thinking and praying about running for president. Here's a man who is very confident about his relationship with a higher power, once performed an abortion, an exorcism. He was a participant in an exorcism and wrote about it, did not do the other. But what about Bobby Jindal? I take him at his word that he's a sincere man and he is a very devout person and that he is praying. Do you think his prayer will say yes or no? What will the answer be when he ultimately decides whether to run for president?
Well, I think when he's discussing religion on a personal level, I think he's also telling the voters who religious right, family forum, all of that group, that he's one of them. It's one of the, he's not the only one who does it. Most of them do it. It's personal with him, but we look at it as campaigning. We look at it as one of the things he's trying to tell a large segment of the voters, that I'm one of you. Will it translate? We won't know till his next election is outside of Louisiana, because most of us think he will run. So you're seeing him spend more time in Iowa, and he'll be there a pretty good bit over the course of the next year.
Well, his inclination is such that he probably will be running for president. He's been traveling the country, and a lot of those stops are in Iowa and places like that, where they're early stops on the 2016 caucus and primary scene. So it looks like he is running, and he is not attending the Southern Governors Conference this week in Little Rock, though. Any thoughts about on his choices for where he travels?
Well, he's going to travel where the primaries lead him. If you look at the and I get comments all the time, or I get questions about it. Your people here can. Does he really think he can win? Well, obviously he does. And when I'm not that familiar with Iowa, although I've been there and I've watched the campaigns. It's who's going to come out of Iowa is anybody's guess. It's sort of a weird place to campaign. It's not a state that votes Republican presidential most of the time. So he goes in there with the hopes of being able to do well. And Jimmy Carter went in there, unknown governor of Georgia. I don't think he was that popular, walked in there and won. And, you know, next thing you know, he's on his way to the White House. So that's what Jindal's trying to do. Is it possible? I don't have any idea, but he's going to attempt it.
I think so. I think he's in the race, and it looks like he's getting a lot of help from the other Republicans. The governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie's enveloped in this bridge scandal, and now Rick Perry in Texas has gone and gotten himself indicted. So maybe Jindal will be the last Republican standing.
You have a point there. Yeah, you've got, like I said, this campaign has a long way to go. He's involved in it. How he fares is anybody's guess. And we here in Louisiana, we can talk about him from a state perspective, but you can't talk about Jindal related to a campaign in Iowa because none of us know. We're really not that tuned in or plugged in to Iowa and how it works. And it is different and it's complicated.
297-5633 for Bernie Pinsonette. Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air with Bernie.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning to your guests. Jim, I heard you say that the governor was praying about his decision to run for president. Now this is a governor who's cut health care, he's cut education, and turned his back on the poor. So my question is, Jim, are you sure he is not praying for when he can stop running for president? Because I think that's the question Louisiana voters would put before Mr. Jindal. I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I think the governor's sincere, but as one who also prays, quite often we pray for what we want. We don't pray for what we don't want. So if he's praying about running for president, he's probably praying not only that he will run, but that he will win. And Bob Mann was on this show a few years ago, and he thought it was unseemly that anybody would pray about something political, that God has bigger things. But I guess the presidency of the United States might be a pretty big thing for God to intervene in. Bernie, what do you think?
Well, when you're discussing this, people tend to placing it back as if we have a decision on this or what he's doing in Iowa. We have he cares what we think. He really doesn't. I mean, he's running for president. He's putting together a campaign raising money, trying to win a primary. Whatever he's done in Louisiana, he's done, and he doesn't face reelection. We won't be talking about him that much as soon as this United States Senate race is over. We'll all be discussing who the next governor will be, and our attention will be turned to that, and Jindal will be out there, but he'll be an afterthought as far as a governor because he's finished in Louisiana. We can't unelect him, so we're stuck with him, or we're happy to have him, depending on your point of view.
Another listener points out that when Edwin Edwards was on this show a few years ago, when he was asked about prayer, he said that prayer is obviously worthless because think of all the popes that have been prayed for as they were on their deathbed. And he said every one of them died anyway. Here's Bill Cassidy sending out a press release the first thing this morning saying in another he's actually quoting from a James Varney column in the Times-Picayune, and another positive sign for Republicans seeking to oust three-term incumbent Mary Landrieu. Her main challenger now has more money, and he has moved ahead in some polls. So is Bill Cassidy, is his stock rising?
Well, it was always going to rise as we got closer to the election. He's been very fortunate that the Democrats have been attacking him and giving him name recognition. He hasn't had to spend a lot of money. He's been able to save his money and to use it down the stretch. So, yeah, the campaign is getting ready to go into a much higher gear between the two candidates, between all the PACs that are coming here. And believe me, this is great for Louisiana's economy. They're going to spend a lot of money in the next couple months in the state. All, you know, in every corner of Louisiana, you're going to see and hear nothing but United States Senate race.
All right, a question from Hal. Do you think a runoff is inevitable in the Landrieu race, or could one of them win in the primary?
It's unlikely. You're looking at a runoff. All probability. Yeah, it's unlikely you would have somebody get over 50%. Landrieu in the polls, at best she's about 40%, and her challenges are, you know, between the combination of the two of them, neither one of them would go over 50%, so you're almost certainly looking at a runoff. It could change. We still have some time to go.
Last time she was forced to a December race, she got 46% in the primary against Susie Terrell, and then got about 51 and 52% in the runoff. So generally, her vote is her vote, and it's hard to get additional votes after the primary. So let's say she's under 45 in the primary. Is that a death knell, or can she come back and win again?
Well, if she's under 45, the problem would be everybody. She would have to find some new voters to get them out to vote, because the people who are not voting for her in the primary are very unlikely to vote for her in a runoff, because it's, you know, the lesser candidates are not going to get enough of a percentage to make up the difference, and nobody thinks that Rob Manis's votes, if he gets 7 or 8 or 10% or whatever he gets, is going to vote for her. So that's why you're looking at some of the national polling firms and analysts saying in the runoff, with Louisiana being such an anti-Obama state, that it would, you know, she faces a serious problem.
Why don't you think Cassidy is more visible? He's running a campaign much like Bennett Johnston did in 1990, when he wouldn't meet David Duke or Benny Baggard on the campaign trail. Like John Breaux in 96, when he wouldn't meet Jim Donilon on the campaign trail. He's running like an incumbent. Is that smart?
Well,
like a popular incumbent.
Yeah, well, he's running based on what the polls say in Louisiana. The majority of people in Louisiana identify themselves Republican-leaning. That's why we don't, you know, Mary's the last statewide elected official who's a Democrat, and that was 6 years. You know, it was 6 years ago at this point in time when she ran, and the world has changed since then. So Cassidy, if you're looking at all this polling data, and you're a Republican and you're running statewide, the odds are, you know, are in your favor. So yeah, he's running as if he should win. I would put it more as if he thinks he'll win.
Okay. Statement by Senator Landrieu's communications director. U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu's communications director says Mary Landrieu has ordered that counsel review all payments made with official funds for her flights during her 18 years of service in the Senate. The counsel will review internal office procedures and make recommendations to ensure accurate payments are made in the future. The findings will be made public once the review is completed, which is expected to be before the Senate returns in September, says Matthew Leonard, the communications director for Senator Landrieu. Does this put this story to rest, or is this one going to last a while?
It's one that she didn't need, but that happens with campaigns because of the enormous amount of money, and most of this stuff is happening quickly, and somebody didn't do the job properly. But I would, you know, it's a story that she doesn't need, but is it going to determine whether she wins or loses? No.
What will determine the winner of that race?
It's Obamacare and Barack Obama. Unless she can get out from under that, the large number of voters in Louisiana who disagree with her vote on Obamacare and who disagree with her supporting or voting with the president, that's the issue. And it's been driving politics in Louisiana for the last three or four years.
Is there a solid favorite going into the governor's election next year, now just 14 months away?
Not really. You have to look at whoever's, you know, it depends. You've got John Bel Edwards running, and you've got everybody talking about a possible Mitch Landrieu. If Mitch runs, John Bel Edwards, you know, evaporates. The Republican side, you'd have to say at the present time that David Vitter is the odds-on favorite, but we have a long way to go. We've got rumors about new candidates getting in. You've got some of the more conservative groups irritated with Vitter over some of the positions he's taken. But, you know, you don't bet. He's never, you know, he's very good at winning elections. He knows how to run them. But this is a governor's race, and anything can happen. So it's
all right. If it's a Vitter-Darden runoff, who wins?
Well, that would be it. It would depend on where the black vote went. Period.
Well, it would seem that
black voters in Louisiana would have a heavy say in the outcome.
I think they would. You're right, but I think they most likely would go to
Darden. Sure.
And if it's Vitter,
well, that's why Vitter is taking some of the stance he's taking. He's trying to get. I think he thinks that he's pretty well sewn up the more conservative part of the voters, and he's trying to move over and cut off voters from Darden to make sure he's not in the runoff.
Warm and fuzzy, David Vitter. Who's not known for being warm and fuzzy, but it will be an interesting year, and we will follow it with Bernie Pinsonat. Thanks, Bernie.
Thank you.
Take care, and we'll be back tomorrow for Frank Barnett. I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.